This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
But today, I want to introduce a different person to you. And that person is Professor Carnesale. He's been teaching his own classes on campus on a variety of national security topics in the past 18 months, I guess, since immediately after September 11. He also delivered, I think, what was a superb lecture on rethinking national security last year in Royce Hall that I'm sure many of you either attended or read about subsequently. And he's generously agreed to take time out from what is a ludicrously busy, dare I say, impacted schedule to spend time today with us talking about his personal intellectual passion, national security. Al Carnesale is an acclaimed expert on national security who's been a leader in scholarly research and policy advice for decades. His academic biography is truly impressive. But rather than regale you with a long list of his accomplishments, I want to introduce him by reading to you from a transcript of some congressional testimony from 1981, a long time ago, concerning an Israeli attack on Iraqi nuclear facilities in 1981. And I want to use this quotation for three reasons. The first one is it demonstrates that he is indeed an expert and was recognized as such by the Congress. Second thing I think you'll get from this quotation, that he's a person of strong views that are always clearly and very forcefully articulated. But the last thing, and one from which I derive immense pleasure, I have to say, is that he is a master of irony and other forms of dry, subtle wit. And I'm going to try to, I hope I can do justice to that skill by reading to you from what is now a pretty old Xerox of congressional testimony from 20 years ago. And the testimony goes like this. There's a inspector, former inspector from the International Atomic Energy Agency, who is in the middle of making a long spiel about some pretty technical stuff having to do with the irradiation of uranium. And the person ends with a statement which is, I have the feeling that it was much less than 1,000 to 1. I have no idea what the 1,000 to 1 means. But Mr. Carnesale replied by saying, I have the feeling that you are wrong. Chairman Zablocki, who was the chairman of the Senate of the subcommittee, said, I did not hear you, Mr. Carnesale. I said, I have the feeling he is wrong. Chairman Zablocki, you have the feeling that he is wrong. Do you have the same feeling, Mr. Richter? That is the person who's accused with being wrong. And then in parens, since this is back to the stage metaphor, there's laughter in parens here, apparently, in the room of the national security testimony. Do you have the same feeling, Mr. Richter? Laughter. My feeling is that he is probably right. More laughter. Chairman Zablocki, well, that was an easy question. Mr. Richter, a point of clarification. Mr. Hamilton, thank you very much, Mr. Carnesale, for your incisive intervention. Al Carnesale is a master of incisive intervention, so I'm going to cede the stage to him. The normal ground rules of these classes will obtain, which is that he will present a lecture for roughly 40 to 45 minutes. We'll then follow with a series, with a Q&A session from the floor. Today we have microphones to help us with that. And then around 1:15 to 1:30, we'll ask people who aren't taking the course for credit to go about your business, and we'll try to do some stuff with the students for the remaining period of the class session. So that's a multifaceted, long-winded introduction of somebody who needs very little or no introduction, Professor Al Carnesale.
Thank you, Jeff, for the warm introduction. I must say, I do remember that testimony. Matter of fact, I looked at it recently, since it was about Iraq, and it was within 2 weeks after the Israeli bombing of the reactor at Osirak, and that would have some of it did seem to be germane. But I looked back, and it held up pretty well. I probably wouldn't have selected the New York wise guy part of the quote to pick, but it's characteristic, so I guess it's fair. I want to thank Jeff and Steve for inviting me to do this. I think this is a valuable service, this course, to the students and to the community. It's one of our ways of trying to respond to the way in which the world has changed since 9/11, and the idea of having these lectures open to the public as well as the students, but at the same time grounded in the academic rigor and having readings associated with it for the students and then further discussions, I think, is a valuable aspect of it. I want to reiterate what Jeff said. That is, I speak today as a professor, not as chancellor. There are times that I pretend to speak for the university. This is not one of them. This time I speak only for myself. Let me begin, as we're going to talk about these changes in national security, by talking about what U.S. tradition has been. This part will echo, to some extent, talks I have given in the past because the tradition hasn't changed. And so I want to talk about the history just a little bit, and then we'll turn to what has changed. American foreign policy, first of all, traditionally has focused on national security. There are other aspects of foreign policy, but U.S. foreign policy has generally been built around national security. Our general pattern has been to identify one or two foreign powers who were considered to be principal adversaries. So if you go back from the time of the Revolutionary War to the late 1800s, you'll find that that principal adversary was Great Britain. Primarily, the principal, not that others didn't arise from time to time. First half of the 20th century, Germany and Japan. Germany in Europe, in the Atlantic. To some extent, we were concerned also about Latin America, Japan in Asia and the Pacific. And, of course, World War I, World War II, an important part of our history and of theirs. Second half of the 20th century, principal adversary was the Soviet Union. Secondary adversary we consider to be the People's Republic of China, and largely because of their association with the Soviet Union, the Red Menace. This was called the Cold War era. 1989, 5 years after this year's freshmen were born, important to remind ourselves. 1989, the Berlin Wall falls. 1991, the Soviet Union collapses. The Cold War is over. And for some time to come, what we described that period as was the post-Cold War era. It was defined not by what it was, but by what it wasn't. It was no longer the Cold War. It wasn't so clear what it was, because suddenly we had no principal adversary, which had always been our mechanism for defining our foreign policy, and so we had no organizing principle for U.S. foreign policy. And if you look back at the decade or more since the collapse of the Soviet Union, you won't find some simple pattern that will describe which conflicts the United States got into, which ones it chose not to get into. It would have been much simpler. If you look back at the Cold War period, it's much easier to figure out what we did and why. Might have been viewed by some as misguided, but it was pretty clear what people were trying to do, and that was contain the Soviet Union by any means possible. Then comes the attack of September 11, 2001. Is this a new era? Is it something more definable than the post-Cold War era? You have seen us struggling with trying to fit what has happened with our tradition. So are terrorists now the principal adversary? Is that the replacement? Think of Osama bin Laden's picture. Is he the principal adversary? Or perhaps more recent weeks, Saddam Hussein, but terrorists were what came to mind immediately after 9/11. And can the defeat of terrorism be our organizing principle for U.S. foreign policy? Let me talk a little bit about national interests, America's national interests. Why talk about national interests? Might seem like a rather abstract subject, but certainly foreign policy and defense policy should be based upon our national interests. Or the way I would often formulate a question like this is, it's important to start with, what are we trying to do? This is not an original question, but it's always insightful. The best form of it that I've seen elsewhere is Friedrich Nietzsche, the philosopher who died in 1900, who said, forgetting our objectives is the most frequent act of stupidity. That's a statement that reminds us to constantly ask the question, what are we trying to do? Now, our national interests, to some extent, reflect our priorities. What do we think is most important? Very often, the most important national interests are labeled vital interests, vital, indispensable, essential to our lives. A way to think of it, these are interests for which we would be willing to send young men and women to die to defend them. That's what we should mean by a vital interest. Interests, national interests, interestingly enough, wind up being connected to capabilities. What abilities do you have to protect these interests? Powerful nations think that they have many more interests, including vital interests, than do weak nations. Was the decision to go to war in Iraq, whatever the reasons, and we'll talk about this more, whatever the reasons you think they might have been, would not the reasons have been the same for Canada or Belgium? How come they didn't decide that it was important for them to go and free the people of Iraq? Mostly because they couldn't. They didn't have the ability. I shouldn't say mostly, but one of the factors is they couldn't. It's not one of their options. They just don't have the military capability to do that. We do. And so powerful countries tend to extend their perceived interests to areas where they believe they have the ability to defend those interests. It's rare that you'll find a nation stating as a vital interest something that it cannot defend. But there arises is the question then, does the mere fact that you can do it mean that you should do it? Now, I've got a fairly simple framework for thinking about national interests myself, and I divide them into three categories: survival, security, and satisfaction, in that order. And it's important to think of it in that order. By survival, I mean protecting our lives and way of life against direct attacks on our homeland. What is it that threatens our lives and our way of life? Mostly weapons of mass destruction. Nuclear weapons, principally, perhaps biological weapons. Generally not chemical weapons. It's hard to imagine a massive change killing large numbers of people with chemical weapons in the United States, but not impossible. Whereas, unfortunately, it's easy to imagine with nuclear weapons. And it's only slightly more difficult with chemical weapons. Those are survival issues. Security issues. By security, I mean we need to avoid and dampen conflicts that might escalate and threaten our survival. So that's why we have such strong interest in seeing or in preventing the rise of a hostile major power in Europe or Asia. We've seen that before. And nowadays, that could threaten our survival. For our security, we consider it important to preserve the viability of global systems. The environment, what happens elsewhere, could affect our survival, our way of life. Preserving financial markets, energy markets, because that could escalate into a conflict that could threaten our survival. And finally, there's satisfaction, by which I mean extending our values and our way of life to others who choose to share them, not stuffing them down other people's throats, but extending them to others who might choose to share them. And in that connection, we have commitments to others that it's important for us to honor, whether it be to the NATO countries, or to Japan, or to Taiwan, or South Korea, or elsewhere. And we have an interest in terms of what we consider to be important for our satisfaction to spread democracy and human rights. But I'm not going to talk about all of these today. What I'm talking about today is survival and vital interests when I talk about our national security. So let me begin with who most threatens the survival of the United States. It used to be, not very long ago, that there wasn't anybody that wouldn't immediately answer that question with the Soviet Union and perhaps the People's Republic of China. And by the way, they still do. If the people in Russia decided today to push a button, it might not happen immediately, but surely within hours, they could have thousands of nuclear weapons going off in the United States. The United States would be gone as a viable society. But it was the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China. They still have that capacity. However, I believe if you ask today who threatens our survival now, the response would relate to terrorism and the axis of evil. The axis of evil is identified by President Bush being Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. And terrorists being this group that global in nature, global communications, advanced technology weapons, global reach. Now, how do these terrorists or the axis of evil threaten the survival of the United States? Had any of these adversaries? It was in the past weapons of mass destruction. It still remains largely seen as weapons of mass destruction, but not in enormous numbers as the Soviet Union or even China. China doesn't have that many, 20 or 30, but one of those can ruin your whole day. 20 major cities changes our lives. Nobody's talking about terrorists having that many, or even generally talking about them having nuclear weapons. But we now are concerned with smaller attacks, more credible attacks, but still with substantial damage, but nothing like Cold War damage. We also worry about not just damage, but disruption of our lives. If you stop and think of the anthrax scare shortly after the time of 9/11 and what it meant for our society and how frightened people were and how they changed the way they lived and their lives and how many people died from anthrax. I think the latest number is six. Six was the number. Or if you think as horrible as it was, the Twin Towers, almost 3,000 people died in New York from that attack. Anybody here have a feeling for how many we lose each week on the highways? How long does it take to get to 3,000? Maybe a month and a half of deaths on the highways. But those are ones we keep in mind. They're closer. They're more realistic. It's more personal. Whereas the idea of this massive Soviet attack with nuclear weapons was simply unthinkable. And fortunately so. So let's talk about America's new adversaries. It's not defined anymore as the Soviet Union or Russia and China. It's now international terrorism and the axis of evil. So in some ways, we're fighting not one war, the Cold War, but four wars: a war against terrorists, a war against Iraq, literally, a war against North Korea, and I will come to what I mean by this, and a war against Iran, because those are the adversaries. Remember, the Cold War wasn't a military war either. Right? We never did fight the Soviet Union. We threatened each other. Now, Amy Sandler, who's my teaching assistant in the courses I've been teaching on national security, couldn't resist the temptation, and since she knows I love things like survival, security, and satisfaction, she came up with names for these wars. If I thought they were bad, I wouldn't use them. I thought they were pretty good. I might have taken credit for them myself, but she's probably here someplace, so I don't dare do that. So the war against terrorism is a war of shadows. The war against Iraq is a war of soldiers. The war against North Korea is a war of speeches. And the war against Iran is a war of silence. Four more S's. Pretty good. So let's talk about the war of shadows first, the war against terrorism. What do we mean by terrorism? And in a sense, it's not proper to call it a war on terrorism. It's a war on terrorists. Terrorism is a phenomenon. Terrorists are the people who perpetrate it. And that might seem like a small technicality, but for those of you that are doing the readings, if you read Brian Jenkins' article, you'll see that the distinction is actually helpful. But a good shorthand is a war on terrorism. What do we mean by terrorism? Well, it's one of these things that's hard to define, but like pornography, you know it when you see it, right? That was the Supreme Court wisdom. But not everybody sees the same thing. And it does have a political dimension to it. There is this phrase, one man's terrorists are the other man's freedom fighters. Not always true. You have to be careful about moral equivalency here, but there is something to it. It is certainly true that the terrorists are usually the ones who are militarily weaker. And so they don't play the game the same way as the stronger side would. That is not to be confused with, and their cause is always right, nor with, and their cause is always wrong. What are defining characteristics of terrorism? One is, it invariably involves premeditated violence. Secondly, it's carried out by subnational groups. In other words, if an army or an air force carries out terrible, violent acts, we don't consider that terrorism. It goes under a different name. By terrorism, we mean non-state actors, subnational groups. It's aimed at civilians, or at least at non-combatants. In other words, they may be people in the military, but if they're working in an office building someplace, that's still considered terrorism generally. And finally, it's done to change the existing political order. It's not a random act of violence. That's what characterizes terrorism. And who are terrorists? Well, as I say, first of all, usually non-state actors, almost by definition, they have to be non-state. They can have different motivations. It could be nationalism, they could be monarchists, they could be left-wing, they could be right-wing, they could be religiously motivated, but they're trying to change the existing political order. A prominent example, Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. What were the objectives of the 9/11 attack? And we've got pretty good evidence that it was Al-Qaeda, so let's use that as our assumption. What were they trying to do? My answer is, I don't know. But let's talk about some possibilities. They never declared quite clearly what the objective was. They might have been, as a popular theory, trying to provoke a U.S. reaction that would be so severe that it would unite the Muslim world as perceiving this as a war of the United States and the West against Islam. They might have been trying simply to demonstrate the vulnerability of the United States, the great Satan, in their eyes. they might have been trying to stimulate political change either in Arab countries, particularly those that have what we call moderate governments, what others would call pro-US governments. They might have been trying to affect the outcome of the Arab-Israeli dispute. They might have been trying all of these, or some combination of these, or others. Now, was that attack successful from the terrorist point of view? I don't know, because I have to know what their objectives were. But it does appear that the attack demonstrated U.S. vulnerability, even though the number of people who died is small compared to what we would normally consider massive destruction. 3,000 people, 3,000 innocent people. It's a lot of people. It certainly did provoke U.S. reaction in Afghanistan and to a substantial degree in Iraq. Remember, the initial connection by the administration for a need to move toward Iraq was a supposed connection to 9/11. And it certainly has stimulated U.S. support, and particularly the president's support, for resolution of the Arab-Israeli dispute, or should I say the Israeli-Palestinian dispute in this context, in a way that's probably more favorable to the Palestinians than it would have been before. So in those ways, the attack does appear to have been successful. And what are some key elements of this war against terrorism, this war of shadows? Remember the Cold War strategy. Cold War strategy was pretty simple: deterrence. In order to ensure that the Soviet Union did not either invade Western Europe or attack the United States, we posed the threat of massive retaliation in one way or another. In other words, they knew we, no matter what they did, we had an arsenal, particularly a nuclear arsenal, that could devastate their military forces and, if deemed appropriate, could devastate their homeland. Now, unfortunately, they could do the same to us. So it was, or fortunately, so it was a stalemate. But that was the strategy, deterrence. Deterrence doesn't seem to be a great strategy against terrorists. What homeland is it that you would destroy in retaliation? What military forces would you attack? So against Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, our strategy first was to deal with this after the fact. Osama, dead or alive. Personalize it. The terrorists would know. And he is now in the shadows. Against Al-Qaeda, we've been attacking what we could be attacking their leadership, attacking their financial sources, attacking their training bases, attacking in many different ways, attacking their cells, attacking their state sponsors. That's what the attack on Afghanistan was all about. It was about their support for Al-Qaeda. We haven't found any link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. And to most students of that part of the world, that comes as no surprise. Iraq has a secular government in a Muslim country. If there's anything Al-Qaeda despises as much as it despises the United States, it's a secular government in a Muslim country. What's another element of our war against terrorism? It's how we organize ourselves for it. We organized ourselves for the Cold War. Somebody asked me a question before class, with the National Security Act of 1947, which reorganized the American government. Many of you may not realize it, but before 1947, there was no Department of Defense. There was no Central Intelligence Agency. There was no National Security Council. Now what we formed is the Department of Homeland Security. Its primary mission, to prevent terrorist attacks, and in events where there are terrorist attacks, to reduce our vulnerability to them. On March 1st, most of the agency actually took shape. It's to have 169,000 employees, making it the third largest department in government behind Health and Human Services and Defense, and an annual budget of $37 billion. It's divided up into five areas. One is information analysis and infrastructure protection. A big part of that means intelligence analysis, getting all the intelligence that deals with terrorism and trying to integrate it. They don't gather it. That's still the CIA's responsibility. Second is border and transportation security, pretty self-explanatory. Third, emergency preparedness and response. They're now also, they worry about earthquakes as well as everything else. Science and technology, how do we use science and technology to help with this problem? And management is the fifth area. Management, a tough area here. It's not only require a degree of coordination among federal agencies, but also state governments, local governments, the private sector, and the like. Parts of this new Department of Homeland Security were taken from almost every department in government. There's one very notable exception that was untouched, the Department of Defense. Nothing went from the Department of Defense to the Department of Homeland Security. So what are the major issues that Department of Homeland Security faces? One is bureaucracy. It's going to be difficult. It's going to take time for this behemoth to be able to act nimbly. It's the biggest reorganization in the U.S. government, certainly since 1947. Funding, $37 billion is a lot of money and wields a lot of influence. At the same time, it's roughly one-tenth of what the Department of Defense will spend this year. And I think what's going to be hardest for this agency is they are at the intersection of domestic and foreign policy. They're the ones that probably more than any other group is going to have to deal with the painful trade-offs between security and civil liberties. Let me turn now to the war with Iraq, the war of soldiers. What were the U.S. objectives for this war? Let me give you a list. It's that most of them are not just my list, they're the administration's list. One is, it's an important part of the war on terrorism. Remember, we were looking for the Iraq connection to Al-Qaeda, and also concerned that Iraq might produce weapons of mass destruction and provide them to terrorists. I don't think we've found evidence of either of those, but if it would have been the case, it would have been pretty frightening. Interestingly enough, this one's harder to appreciate in hindsight, but one of our principal reasons was to support the United Nations. Remember, there were these 16 United Nations resolutions that we thought, we believed, and indeed it was the fact, that Iraq was not in full compliance with, and to preserve the credibility of the United Nations, it was important to enforce the UN resolutions. A third stated objective was regime change. Saddam Hussein is unquestionably an evil tyrant, and the idea was to eliminate that regime and liberate the Iraqi people. A fourth, more recent rationale is to democratize the Middle East, that this was going to have a domino effect, what we call democracy dominoes. Some of you may remember the domino effect from Vietnam. Actually, it's even before, it was one was called Indochina, French Indochina. In 1954, President Eisenhower referred to the problem of how one country and after another, first it would be Indochina, then this one down, they would go down like a stack of dominoes. Well, this is a reverse domino effect. We're going to have one democracy in Iraq, and then others are going to arise all around the Middle East, then we'll have stability in that region. And then the fifth one, of course, never mentioned by the administration, but it's got to be in the calculation someplace, is oil. It's one of the things that makes this region so important to us and why we want stability there, is world energy supplies, which are very important to international trade and to our ways of life. And it is true that weapons of mass destruction in the hands of an Iraqi tyrant could indeed threaten the United States. Now let's look at what Saddam's dilemma was through all this when he's trying to figure out how's he going to deal with the UN resolutions calling for disarmament. One, we'll take two cases. One, we'll assume he has no weapons of mass destruction, where he got rid of them all. And then we'll consider case two, where he has weapons of mass destruction and it's kept them. In case one, let's say he has weapons of mass destruction, or excuse me, he has none. Let's take that case first. Has none. How can he prove that he doesn't have any? That's impossible, right? That's proving a negative. If I had inspectors running all around Iraq all the time, a million of them, the best they could ever tell me was, we haven't found any yet. Right? It's not possible to prove there are none. So if he's worried that I've got to prove to the United States I don't have any, the Americans are going to attack, this is hopeless. Right? So why would he even think of getting rid of the ones he might have? The reason would be, if he does have them, because maybe I can influence the international community enough that they will prevent the United States from attacking. It's a tricky business, because if he doesn't have them or gets rid of them in an effort to convince the international community that he doesn't have any, and then we attack anyway, now we attack him and he's got no weapons of mass destruction to use against us and none to deter us. Tough situation, no matter how you think of it. Certainly, from what we know already, he did not have substantial stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. We may find that he has some chemical weapons. That remains to be seen, which he has not used, interestingly enough. What about U.S. options at this stage? Well, first of all, it appears that the military phase of the war is virtually over, highly successful for the United States and Great Britain. The British Marines played a very important part in this war. No weapons of mass destruction has been used. What's next? What's next is the hard part politically. And that's the nature of governance in Iraq and what it looks like elsewhere. Initially, it will certainly be a military occupation. Will that continue indefinitely? Well, for how long? Will the UN have a role? And if so, how substantial? Will there actually be a transition to democracy? And when? Not an easy place to simply turn it over and say, okay, you guys take charge. You got Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds. This is a lot like the Balkans that was held together by Tito, that only a tyrant held it together. What will happen? Will it be stable? Now comes the hard part. And what will be the future of the current Iraqi leadership? What happens with Saddam and his cronies? So we face a number of issues. This isn't over yet. But many of the worst fears have turned out not to be the case. Not large numbers of casualties, no use of weapons of mass destruction, no house-to-house fighting, or no significant house-to-house fighting in Baghdad. So far, so good, militarily. The costs have been high. Thus far, the war itself, about $80 billion, is UCLA's budget for 27 years. Occupation will be tough, as I indicated, a lot of tough issues there, and reconstruction. There'll be other costs, the side payments. I mean, we paid a lot of countries. We promised them aid in return for their support. Diplomatic issues we'll have to face. How do we deal with the fact that to many countries in the world, it appears that we just acted unilaterally in defiance of the UN, even though the UN never voted, was never brought to a vote, should the United States go in or not, but appears to be in defiance of the UN. We've got this rift with two of our staunchest allies, France and Germany. And there's the danger of undermining the United Nations. These are all challenges we're going to be starting to meet now. But biggest, in my mind, the biggest unknown and the biggest challenge is what will happen to the stability of the Middle East. Will we have democracy dominoes? Or will the dominoes go the other way? And will we see the collapse of moderate governments in Arab countries, replaced by political, religious governments? I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. Now let me turn to the war with North Korea, the war of speeches. First of all, what's the situation? Let me sort of do a quick rundown. What we're worried about there, again, is weapons of mass destruction, but this time it's nuclear weapons, the worst of the weapons of mass destruction. Our estimate is that North Korea has now enough plutonium to make one or two nuclear weapons. They could conceivably have already made them. They've got plutonium that's tied up in the fuel from their nuclear reactor, spent fuel, as we call it, that could be processed to separate the plutonium and make about six more nuclear weapons. That would take a few months, several months to do that. And then if they keep operating their reactor, the one they have now, they produce enough plutonium to make about another bomb per year. Now, we had a deal in 1994 called the Agreed Framework between North Korea on the one hand and the United States, South Korea, and Japan on the other, under which North Korea froze its nuclear facilities at Pyongyang, at Yongbyon. Yongbyon is the nuclear facility, Pyongyang the capital. Froze mean they weren't operating the reactor, they weren't operating reprocessing facilities, they weren't producing plutonium, they weren't separating plutonium. In return, what they got from us was a pledge of fuel oil, 500,000 tons per year, and a commitment that we would build two nuclear power plants of designs that could not be used to produce bombs. And those power plants would each cost $1 or $2 billion. This agreement was never fully carried out for one political reason or another. North Korea essentially walked away from the agreed framework. Precise words where they set aside the agreed framework. And more recently, they announced that they're withdrawing from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Indeed, the United Nations Security Council is meeting today to discuss North Korea's withdrawal from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is very significant. There are only three countries in the world that are not parties to the Non-Proliferation Treaty: India, Israel, and Pakistan, each of whom refused to join it because they intended to get nuclear weapons. And each of them did: India, Israel, and Pakistan. North Korea would be the first country to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They've thrown out the inspectors, closed down the surveillance equipment, all out of North Korea now. Now, what's North Korea trying to do? Again, I start these the way I always start: I don't know. But I'm in good company with North Korea. There are no experts on North Korea. Or whatever experts they are, they're in North Korea. There are lots of specialists who claim to know something about North Korea, but I haven't met any of them who, when you get into a conversation and they tell you what they actually know, it turns out it's not much. North Korea is a black box. It's hard to learn, just the nature of the society. So I don't know, but let me say at least a couple of possibilities. First of all, North Korea and the North Korean regime has been paranoid for years. They've always worried about and seem to be genuinely worried about an attack by the United States in conjunction with South Korea. Didn't help that then they're assigned to the Axis of Evil, right? So they're given early membership in this exclusive club. They see that we're going to Iraq, the rationale being regime change. doesn't sound too good if you're running North Korea. And then finally, the U.S. comes out with an important aspect of its national security policy generally, which is extending the doctrine of preemption. In other words, we don't have to wait until there are forces on the other side, on weapons on the other side, that pose a clear and imminent danger to us. We can attack before they exist because we believe the other country is trying to put them together. That's an extension of preemption, but if you look at any of this from the point of view of North Korea, doesn't sound good. Now, they could have had another strategy as well, another objective, and that's this is all part of a negotiating game. This is a bargaining chip. They see we're involved with terrorism, we're involved with Iraq, we're not going to want to also start getting involved with North Korea. This is a way to strike a better deal than the agreed framework of 1994, and maybe they can enhance that deal. There are other things you can think of. I don't know. Those are pretty much span the space. So what are our options? What can we do here? Well, it's not easy. I mentioned some countries that care about this a lot. Russia, China, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and now the United Nations is engaged. We don't know much about what's going on there. We don't know much about North Korea's capabilities, although we have some good estimates there. But we know very little about is North Korea's intentions. As a fact, we also know that Seoul, South Korea, is only 30 miles or so from North Korea. It can be reached by artillery, short-range missiles. Enormous damage could be done to Seoul by North Korea. And indeed, parts of Japan are within range of North Korean missiles. You could say, well, why don't we just preempt and destroy their nuclear weapons and their nuclear facilities? Let's not talk hawks, doves, morality, non-morality. Let's talk hard intelligence choices. Are you positive you know where they all are? Because if you attack and preempt and they're left with three nuclear weapons, they're going to be very angry. So it looks again like diplomacy remains the least bad option. That's why this is a war of speeches. And in the UN today, there are speeches. What's a plausible outcome? Opinion, just one, I'm not going to do a whole bunch of them, that North Korea is a deal. North Korea refreezes the nuclear facilities at Yongbyon. They account for all of the plutonium or highly enriched uranium from which you could make nuclear weapons. They accept nationwide inspection by the International Atomic Energy Agency for nuclear facilities, and they remove the spent nuclear fuel that's got plutonium in it. In return, what do the U.S. and Japan and Korea have to do? Keep their part of the deal on the fuel oil and the nuclear power plants, perhaps offer a non-aggression pledge just in case North Korea really believes the stuff about an attack. And then it's more difficult, what about improving diplomatic ties with North Korea? The biggest concern here is just the danger of a proliferation cascade. What will this mean for the non-proliferation treaty if countries start to withdraw because they feel a need to acquire a nuclear weapon? Could be a distraction from our war on terrorism and our occupation and liberation and rebuilding of Iraq. Costs again, financial, diplomatic, risks to South Korea and Japan. And I'll just mention in passing that national missile defense does not solve any of these problems. Maybe some problem someplace that it solves, but not this. And of the final war, the war with Iran, the war of silence, let me turn to that. A little bit about Iran's nuclear history that seems to have been forgotten in the press. In the early 1970s, Iran, then run by the Shah of Iran, acquired its first nuclear reactor. It was supplied by the United States. It was under international safeguards, inspected by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Within the next few years, the Shah completed contracts to assure that there would be nuclear fuel for that reactor. And those contracts were signed with the United States and with Germany and with France. When the Shah fell in 1979, Iran had contracts with the Western countries to provide six large nuclear power plants, and two of them were more than halfway completed by that time. But of course, with the fall of the Shah, Western help ceased for a while. Now, what's the situation today? Again, we don't know. We do know what we're reading the newspapers, so to speak. And U.S. officials maintain that in Iran there's a uranium enrichment facility, a facility that could be used to produce fuel for a power plant, but could also be used to produce highly enriched uranium for use in bombs. This facility is under construction, and intelligence estimates are it could start to operate in about 2005 and could produce enough highly enriched uranium for several bombs per year, if that's what it's for. The Russians are assisting Iran in building a nuclear power plant in a different place. And Iran has refused to commit itself not to have uranium enrichment facilities or plutonium processing facilities to make materials from which you could make bombs, but you could also use it for nuclear power. So there are suspicious activities, but no hard evidence that they're violating the non-proliferation treaty. Now, what's Iran trying to do? I always try to put myself, in the other fellow's shoes. And the answer, again, is I don't know, but what about some things they might be? First of all, they might actually feel a need for nuclear weapons. They live in a pretty tough neighborhood. Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkey, and Turkmenistan. And certainly within range of missiles, Russia, China, India, just to mention nuclear powers. It's a tough neighborhood, and they may feel insecure. They may be feeling isolated ever since the hostage trauma of 1980. They have certainly been isolated from the United States and much, but not all, of the West. And once again, being awarded membership in the Axis of Evil may have them thinking about things differently. They may just have a nuclear power program. All of these things are possible. What are our options? Again, not easy. We have no formal relations with Iran. That makes it sort of tricky to conduct diplomatic talks. Russia and the European Union have extensive economic ties in Iran. As a matter of fact, the European Union is Iran's leading trading partner. We could preempt, but you better know where everything is. And it would be rather embarrassing if you preempted and destroyed what was a perfectly legitimate civilian facility. You could talk about it a little bit, but mostly react to it by ignoring it. That's why this is the war of silence. Diplomacy is worth a try. To go at this one, you'd have to support and strengthen the non-proliferation treaty and probably all other arms control agreements that we'd have to be willing to support and strengthen, like the Chemical Weapons Convention, the Biological Weapons Convention. You'd have to recognize and reward countries that are in complete compliance with the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and we'd have to reduce our rhetoric that increases nations' incentives to acquire nuclear weapons because they're worried about what we might do. We're worried about, again, just a proliferation cascade, a distraction, the war with terrorists in Iraq. And we have to ask ourselves the question, are we ready for formal relations with Iran? So those are the four wars. Let me just try and make a few final summation remarks. First of all, you've noticed throughout I've tended to focus on weapons of mass destruction as opposed to other kinds of bad things that people could do against us. And that's because I want to focus on our most vital of interests, that is survival. That's intentional. And I think it's important for us to keep our eye on that ball, not only with regard to these four wars, but also with regard to the thousands of nuclear weapons that are still in Russia and to make sure that they don't get into the wrong hands. We want to preserve and strengthen a non-proliferation regime because weapons of mass destruction are so important. This has been a regime that's been remarkably successful, whether because of hard work, good luck, God's will, I don't know, but remarkably successful. The number of countries that have nuclear weapons today compared to 25 years ago is either the same or one more. It's been a remarkably successful regime. Let's keep it that way. Secondly, we have to recognize that there has been a revolution in U.S. national security. But the revolution is a little different than a lot of other people think. The revolution is that we are clearly and unambiguously the world's only superpower. That's the revolution, militarily and economically. We will spend on defense this year more than the defense budgets of all the other countries in the world put together. That's because of the added expense of the war. Without the war, we'd be spending more than the next 25 countries in the world. We are the sole superpower, economically as well. Bad as our economy is, it's better than anybody else's, and a lot bigger. The U.S. is so powerful, we can do almost anything, but we can't do everything. We're going to have to, in deciding what we do, take into account not only our capabilities, but our interests and our values as well. That's what has to guide us. That's what's true in this new world. We are less limited by our capabilities than we ever have been in the past. Now, people in this room, quite varying ages, how many people remember Pogo? The comic strip Pogo? Very few. All right, let me say a couple of words about Pogo. Walt Kelly wrote this comic strip. And one of the most famous of the strips was Earth Day in 1971. This became a thing. And Pogo is concerned about the environment, and he's staring out, looking at his swamp where he lives. And it's just littered with tires and old refrigerators and garbage and junk. And Pogo says, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." He's talking about the global environment. Well, in this case, when we look at what do we do next, it's, to paraphrase Pogo, we have met the experts, and they is us. This world is very different than the world in which I grew up and came to be an expert on national security, in which Donald Rumsfeld grew up and became an expert on national security, Colin Powell, Condi Rice, Paul Wolfowitz, any of us. Well, this world is very different, and we're doing our best to adapt. But our best source of wisdom for new ideas and better policies is an informed and educated citizenry. That's where it's going to come from. It's going to come from the new, not from the old. And so to the students in this room especially, I say, we're counting on you. Thank you very much.
Wonderful presentation.